Good, it's pretty sensitive. This is a conversation between Mel Harder and Walter Langford on June 14th, 1982, in Mel Harder's place in Sun City, Arizona. So, Mel, I suppose you started playing ball in Beamer.
No, I didn't. I didn't start playing ball until I was in Omaha.
About what age then?
Well, we moved to Omaha when I was 2 years old. Mm-hmm. And I started playing ball when I was in grade school, and I continued on through high school and mm-hmm. and amateur ball, and that's where I started in professional ball from Omaha.
Were you always a pitcher?
Always a pitcher.
Yeah.
That's right. I never played any other position. It just seemed like it was just natural for me to get out there and
throw it.
Mm-hmm.
Who first brought you into organized ball?
Well, I started in organized ball with Omaha, the Western League.
Yeah.
I signed with Omaha in 1927.
Mm-hmm.
Barney Birch was the owner of the club, and he signed me right out of high school. And I went to my first spring training in 1927 with Omaha.
Mm-hmm. And you only were 1 year in the minors then?
Well,
you got to the majors sometime the next year.
Right. Well, I was with Omaha there at the beginning of the season in 27, and along about latter part of April, they sent me over to Dubuque, Iowa in the mm-hmm. Mississippi Valley League.
Mm-hmm.
And I stayed over there for 2 months. Dubuque Club in that Mississippi Valley League, it was a non-option league. Nobody was supposed to option players mm-hmm. for that league, and they were supposed to be all owned by the individual clubs.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Omaha had sort of a tail on me then, and other clubs found that out over in that league, and they had a meeting, and they threw out all my games July 1st. I'd won 13 and lost 8 in just a couple of months. And they threw out the 13 games and then sent me back to Omaha. And then I was sold to Cleveland by Omaha about August 15th of that year.
Mm-hmm. And Cleveland brought you up at the end of the 28 season, apparently.
I joined Cleveland in spring of 1928.
Ah.
Uh-huh. And
did they option you out again?
No. No, I stayed the full year with Cleveland in 1928,
mm-hmm.
and 1929 I started the season with them again, and I was with them up until August 15th, long about August 15th, September. New Orleans was in a pennant race, and they needed a pitcher,
mm-hmm.
so Cleveland sent me down for 6 weeks to New Orleans, and I finished the season with New Orleans. I won 7 and lost 2, and then I went right back to Cleveland, and I spent the rest of my career then.
And you sure did. That's a rare thing these days, that somebody will spend 15 or more years in the same team.
Yes, it is. I don't think that's going to happen too often now.
It was pretty common in your day, but not terribly common even then. I mean, a lot of the players, when they had passed their prime and their peak and were on the way down, would be let go by their first team and sign on briefly with somebody else. There are a lot of them that show that in the record books, you know.
That's right. They weren't
really traded for somebody of equal quality in the middle of their career. They just
right.
kind of...
Well, they still had the ability, and they would finish up with maybe a couple of
yeah.
clubs, and
that's right.
the way it happened.
Yeah. Okay, now, do you remember your first win?
Well, it's kind of hard, Walter.
Yeah, I see that in 29, You had one win and no losses, but no complete games, so you probably got it in relief.
Well, in 1928, I did mostly relief work.
Yeah.
And I had finished up games.
Mm-hmm.
Long around the 7th, 8th inning, Roger Peckinpah, our manager, would put me in, and I don't recall how many games I pitched in, but I imagine it's around 15 or so.
The first year, they show you in 23 games.
23 games. Well, they were all relief jobs.
49 innings. Yeah.
Yeah, they were all relief jobs, and I got quite a bit of experience just by getting in against those good hitters.
You're darn right, and there were plenty of them in those days.
I was only 18 years old, and and green as they make them, but I had a good arm, I had a good sinker, and I hadn't developed my curve yet. It took me about 2 years to develop a good curve, and then once I developed that curve, 1930, I started to win some ball games.
You did, indeed. And kept right on for a long time. I noticed one on the record here. In 1941, you only had 9 decisions, 5 wins and 4 losses. Were you, did you have a sore arm or anything that year, or what would that?
Well, my troubles with my arm started in 1936. I had a real good season going. I had 12 victories and 3 defeats.
Is that
at
right?
All-Star time in around the 1st of July. And I pitched in the All-Star game in Boston.
Mm-hmm.
And then we went to Philadelphia, and I rested for 3 days. And then I pitched in Philadelphia, and along about the 5th inning, I felt a twinge in my shoulder.
Mm-hmm.
And I knew something happened. But I went ahead and I finished that ball game. But the next day,
you
couldn't even raise my arm. I couldn't comb my hair. I couldn't do anything. And from that day on, I had trouble with my arm.
All the way through?
Well, from 1936 on out.
Yeah.
And I had an arm operation in 1940, in the winter of 1940.
That's probably why you weren't as active in 41.
That's right. Yeah. My arm got pretty bad. I had some chips removed from my elbow.
Yeah.
And
you still had 240 innings that year, though. No, hold it. You had only 68 innings.
In 40?
41.
41.
Yeah.
And I, it was really a struggle. But then once I got those chips out, I rested the arm during the winter, and I went to spring training with the Indians, and my arm started to come around again after it got strong.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Real good. All right. Now, do you remember your first appearance in the major leagues?
Yes, I do. I think that always is a sort of a standout.
Sure.
Ought to be, you know, a deal with a young player.
Mm-hmm.
It was a game in Cleveland, the Detroit Tigers. We went into the 9th inning and we tied the ball game. I don't recall the score, but Roger Peckinpah surprised me by putting me in the 10th inning and to start the inning. And I pitched the 10th inning, but I got in trouble. I got one man on, and then he stole second base on me.
Mm-hmm.
And then they got a base hit and scored the run that went ahead. That was my first ball game. I got the loss.
Yeah. Not anything to be
No.
surprised or ashamed about in your first game at that age in the majors. Now, you mentioned Peckinpah. You played under a variety of managers there.
Yes, I did.
What comments as far as their managing or their about those guys as persons, and Peckinpah and Walter Johnson, Steve O'Neill, Ossie Vitt, Lou Boudreau, which one do you think was the best manager?
Well, I played for and I worked under 13 managers in my career in Cleveland. And they were all real good baseball men because they spent a lot of time in baseball.
Yeah, a lot of these people had.
And they all had different personalities, and it all depended on the club that you had. You know, ball players help make the manager, and the manager helps in a few spots and keeps the ball club going. But I always admired Roger Peckinpah because he was my first manager.
Uh-huh.
And he taught me quite a bit, and he carried me along for a couple of years there, and really gave me the experience that
to
I
develop.
Needed. And finally, I after 2 years, I started to work regular, and I started to win. But I Walter Johnson was a fine manager, but he had the trouble of handling a couple ball players on the ball club, and that just sort of snowballed on him. And and then we went through Steve O'Neill was one of my best friends in baseball, and he was a fine gentleman.
Was he still catching when you came in?
No.
No.
He was with the Browns when I first started with the Indians.
Okay.
And I think he might have been still catching just a few games.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then he started managing. But Steve was a fine baseball man. But yes. I admired Al Lopez quite a bit as a manager.
Oh, sure.
He had what it takes, and he never overmanaged.
I didn't realize he was managing when you were there, was he?
Oh, yes. I was a coach under him.
I'll be darned.
Yeah.
That was after you finished playing.
I finished in 47, and Al Lopez was he finished with the Indians in 47.
Well, now, was he the manager when you took over for one game in 61?
No.
No?
No. That one game was when Jimmy Dykes was fired, and...
Yeah.
He was fired on the next to the last day of the season, and I just finished the season.
Well, you got the best record in baseball as manager. 1,000%.
That's all I did.
Now, tell me, did the pitching coaches, or do they today, for the most part, exercise a really great influence on pitchers, especially young pitchers?
Well, I do. I think that the pitching coach...
Were you a pitching coach under Lopez?
No. Yeah.
Who were the pitching coaches when you were pitching?
Well, they didn't have pitching coaches then.
I wonder.
They didn't really start... they didn't start having pitching coaches until long about 48, I think.
Mm-hmm.
I think Bill Beck... was one of the first to have it.
Back figures.
He made, when I was released as a player for the Indians, Bill Beck gave me the job as pitching coach for the entire organization. I went to the major league camp and spring training, and then after the major league club broke camp, I went to the minor league camp in Florida and worked down there. And then I worked in the minor leagues for a short time, and then went back to the big club, the Indians, and then I stayed there.
I don't think pitching coaches as a body get probably as much credit as they deserve. You hear about certain ones of them being supposedly outstanding for a while. Johnny Sane was supposed to be developing lots of good pitchers and others, but right now the Padres in San Diego, with Dick Williams giving them real managing skill for the first time in their history.
Yeah, he was doing a good job.
Yeah, and he brought with him Norm Sherry as pitching coach, who had been with him in Montreal, and apparently that guy too knows what he's doing, because he certainly had some good results in Montreal, and the Padre pitching staff has been, I think, the surprise of the team. That's what's making them click, as much as, well, Williams is the manager, and the trades that Jack McKeon made and brought players
in. They got a good ball club now.
Yeah, they could pull a miracle. It would take almost that to move from the depth they've been in up to this point and capture their division. But I think the division is weak this year. Cincinnati and Houston and even L.A., I don't believe, are up to their best form.
That's right.
And Atlanta is just as big a surprise as the Padres.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know too much about the National League. I didn't see any National League clubs down here, but I saw a few American League clubs. And
I was always an American League fan myself, but I've seen a lot of National League games through the years.
Yeah. Well, I think pitching coaches have a good deal to help a manager on his on his strategy and everything. But there's so many pitchers that they lack just one or two things to make them a good pitcher, like control, or maybe they lack a breaking pitch, like a slider or a curveball, lack of change of pace.
Yep, and a lot of them lack that.
So a pitching coach can help considerably there, and he has time to work with these fellas,
and even psychologically, and the pitcher's mental outlook and approach to things, especially after he got two or three guys get hits off him, some pitchers tend to collapse.
That's right.
Lose their cool.
Well, I know when Bob Lemon first started to pitch, he had the idea that he had to throw a ball by a hitter all the time.
Of course,
Lamb had one of the best sinkers I think I've ever seen.
Yeah.
And the harder he threw, the less the ball would sink.
Sure.
You know? And it just took a while for Lamb to
learn that.
Realize that, and it took him a while to believe that he didn't have to throw so hard to get a ball by a hitter or something.
Yeah.
But he had a terrific sinker.
Yeah. Yeah, I saw Lamb pitch various times.
Yeah.
What about that 1940 season and all the hullabaloo about Oscar Witt and everything? You were there.
Yeah.
Did he lose the respect of the players in that season, or what would you say?
Well, he did lose the respect of the players, and it all started the way Oscar Witt would operate. He'd pat you on the back on 1 minute, and then kind of criticize you the next minute to somebody else, and it was sort of a two-faced way of doing things, you know. And it finally got to some of the players, and we had a good ball club. And Bob Feller, Hal Trosky, Jeff Heath, they all thought that we had a chance to win a pennant, but they didn't think we could win it with Oscar Witt managing. Well, Johnny Allen and myself tried to calm this thing down to where the players wanted to go to Mr. Bradley, our owner, right away.
Yeah.
And we tried to talk him out of it, Johnny and myself. We wanted to go to Mr. Bradley just ourselves, just Johnny and myself. That wouldn't cause any publicity. Nobody would know about it.
Mm-hmm.
But the way it happened, they wanted to go see Mr. Bradley. The whole club went down there. Well, everybody who saw the club walk in Mr. Bradley's office knew that there was something going on. So that's how it started.
Yeah, he only lost it by one game, and as I remember, wasn't that the last game of the season? This character only won two games in the major leagues, Floyd Gebel or something. Gebel, yeah. Shut you out.
Two That's nothing. Right. We couldn't hit him with a paddle that day. We had a good ball club. It was a shame.
Yeah, you should have won it. I agree with you. Yeah. Well, what about Lou Boudreau as a manager?
Lou is a good manager. And he had some of the best years. As a player, when he was manager, and that helped considerably there.
Mm-hmm.
And he was he had respect from all the ball players, and he was a good leader.
Yeah,
he was a very good leader.
There haven't been too many player managers since him.
No,
or at least players who were full time and producing the way
That's
he
right.
did.
He was a good leader, and he'd lead it with his own ability.
Yeah, by his example.
Yeah.
Too bad you didn't stick around for one more year. You'd have been in the 48 World Series.
Yeah, I missed that.
You missed one in 40 by one game, and missed the 48 one by one season.
That's right. I was thankful to get in two World Series, one in 48 and one in 54,
mm-hmm.
as a coach. So
yeah.
That kind of took some of the sting away.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, at least you don't have the regrets that Feller must have, finally getting into two and never winning a World Series
yeah,
game.
That's right.
Yeah,
he was. That's too bad. Of course,
yeah.
We had some good ball clubs through there, but we just
didn't quite
happen to run into the Yankees a few years, and
they really dominated, didn't
yeah.
they?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It was not, I don't think, the best thing for the American League.
Oh, they just gradually wore the league down. You know,
yeah.
we would hold our own for a few months going into maybe June or July, but they had too much.
Yeah,
they just
they
kept
did.
Going.
I was a great in those years, great Chicago White Sox fan, and in the 50s they finally came to life, you know, and. Threatened and pushed the Yankees a few times, but always we get clubbed at the wrong moment, and got Lopez to come over, and he earned the title of being the best second place manager in history with
right.
Cleveland and Chicago.
Yeah, that's right.
All because of those Yankees. Let's talk a little about some of the players you played with, and then we may mention some that you saw on other teams. Was Wes Farrell still at his best when you got there? He must have been, yeah.
Well, Wes and I came up together.
Oh, did you?
In 1928.
Mm-hmm.
They sent Wes to Terre Haute in 1928, and they kept me on the club.
Mm-hmm.
And in 1929, Wes stayed with the Indians.
Yeah.
And then he proceeded to win 20 games or more 4 consecutive years.
Yeah, he had some good years, but I'm just looking for one thing. He didn't hang on terribly long, although I see he did go, he was still pitching in 41 for the Boston Braves a little
well,
bit.
Well, I think he left the Indians and went to
Boston.
Red Sox,
yeah,
right?
He was 27-33 in Cleveland, 34-37 Boston. 38 Washington, 39 Yankees, 40 Brooklyn, 41 Braves.
Yeah.
That's that history of getting shots with several teams for a year or part of a year and the end of your career that a lot of players show.
Yeah, he had this 4 consecutive 20-game seasons with Cleveland, and then I think that his arm started to bother him along about 33.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't long before our club decided to trade him.
Yeah. Now, didn't Rick Farrell catch for Cleveland, too?
No. Rick caught for the Browns and Washington.
Yeah. Somehow I thought they were together, the brothers, for a while there, but they weren't.
Well, it might have been... He might have been with the Washington. I don't know.
No.
Rick was with Washington. But I don't. I can't remember him.
I don't think so.
Yeah. Anyway, I'm hopeful of seeing Rick, who lives in Detroit, and I've got an appointment to come up with Billy Rogel in Detroit.
Oh, there. Yeah, he's a politician, isn't he?
Well, he was. He's now retired. He tells me. In fact, he answered my letter from Florida. Says I live down here now. Your letter finally caught up with me. I'd be glad to talk with you. And I thought to myself, well, hell, I can't make it to Florida. But he says, I'll be in Detroit practically all summer.
Oh.
And he says, when I retired or resigned from city councilman's post, I moved to Florida. But Jack Kelly, who is councilman in Detroit, his secretary will know where I can be reached in Detroit when you come through. So I'll see him there. And
yeah.
Maybe I can get Farrell. He's one of the ones.
That fits against Billy a lot.
Yeah, he had a pretty good career. Now, the Sewell brothers.
Yeah.
Joe had been there 8 years when you first showed up and stayed a while longer. He didn't have as long a career as Luke, but was he an outstanding shortstop?
When I first joined the Indians in 28, he was a shortstop, but he was beginning to
lose his range.
Yeah, he's kind of slowing up a little, so they moved him to third base.
That's right, I remember that.
And but he was still he was still a good hitter.
Oh, he was,
yeah, he
always
was a good
hitter, wasn't he?
Yeah.
Well, anyway.
And he was one of these fellows that it was tough to strike out, you know.
Oh, yeah, he had that name. Like Nellie Fox later and various others.
Yeah, Max Bishop.
Yeah.
Those guys, they were tough to strike out.
They combined awfully good, I guess, awfully good eyesight with mighty good reflexes and also lots of discipline at the plate.
Oh, yeah.
To be able to do that.
Well, they had a good eye.
Yeah, got to be a good eye.
They didn't try to
Overswing.
All they did was meet the ball, and they were tough that way. You couldn't throw a ball by them, or you know, when they're overswinging.
Yeah. How about Earl Averill?
Earl joined the Indians in 29, and he was a good hitter.
He sure was.
He used one of the heaviest bats. I think in the league, it was over 40 ounces all the time.
Wow.
And he could hit the long ball and
also hit for average.
Good, consistent hitter.
Yeah. Charlie Jameson.
Well, Charlie was probably the one of the best left fielders that Cleveland's ever had. And he also was a good hitter, not so
not
much
for
power, but he'd hit pretty average all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And I know in 1928 he was really one of the most popular ball players on the Indians.
Mm-hmm. You were there when Bibb Falk came over from the White
Sox.
Mm-hmm. He played a few years with Cleveland.
Well, Bibb, he played right field, but I think that Bibb was on his way down at that time.
No doubt.
And he finished a few years with Cleveland there.
Mm-hmm.
But Bibb, and again, was one of he was a good hitter, very good hitter.
Yeah.
And he was another one of those fellows that. Probably was slowing up a little in the outfield, but he could still swing that bat.
I guess it's natural that some people will slow up at an earlier age than others. I mean, there's some that in their early 30s begin to lose it.
Oh, sure.
Some others won't till they're past, close to 40, and then some, like Pete Rose, just go on.
Yeah, they just, their legs stand up.
That's right. That's the key to it.
Yeah, he was with Cleveland, Bibb was, only 29 to 31. But he has a lifetime average of 314, which stacks up pretty good.
Oh, he was a good hitter.
I wrote
him. You
know,
a good steady hitter, right?
I contacted him in regard to all of this, and he answered. He lives in Austin, Texas, and I'm going to be there, be in San Antonio, get there very easily. He says, thanks a lot, but really the only person I interview these days is my doctor.
Is that what he said?
Yeah.
Bibb used to like the horses.
Did he?
No, yeah. He and Willie Cam were together in Cleveland, you know.
Yeah.
And the two of them used to love those horses.
I would have been interested in Willie, except that he was in one of these other two books that I mentioned. I don't want to duplicate any people I had in there. They had some mighty good ones, Charlie Gehringer and others that I would have been interested in. But
he came over from the White Sox.
Yeah,
was with Cleveland for a few years.
Yeah. Yeah. How was Joe Vosmick?
Joe, he's one of the best outfielders, and I think Cleveland's had. He was a good hitter. Boy, I'll tell you, when he was just breaking in with Cleveland along about 1930-31,
mm-hmm.
Well, he was one of the best looking hitters I think I've ever seen.
Mm, great.
And most underrated ball player I was around. I just can't figure things out on him. Like the Ohio Hall of Fame, you know, mm-hmm. that they got there. He hasn't got into it yet.
Mm.
And there's other ball players that's been voted into it that can't compare with it.
Sometimes it becomes a popularity contest, personality.
Well, the quiet guy is a big thing.
Right? Yeah, yeah. But the quiet guy is not as apt to get as much of that.
No, that's right.
Yeah.
I know, that's where I had my trouble all the time. They always used to tell me, why don't you go out and blow your horn a little more, you know. And
some people are not made for that.
I just never did that. And Joe was the same way, and Joe, he was a good hitter. If I wanted to teach somebody how to hit in those years, I would have told them to go
watch
Joe.
Joe.
Yeah.
Joe wound up with a 307 average.
He did, huh?
Yeah, from 30 to 44.
Yeah. But with Cleveland, he had some good.
Yeah, average. He was probably a higher average that time, yeah. When Sam Rice got to Cleveland, he was toward the end of his days.
Yeah,
right?
he was
no longer the base runner that he had been. Yeah.
No, Sam was beginning to, you know, show it, the age. His age at that time, he was slowing up, and he just finished up, more or less.
I'm going to talk with Willis Hudlin in Little
Rock. Are you?
Yeah. In fact, I got more Cleveland players so far than from any other single team. Just somehow they wanted to participate, and they live where I can get to, I guess.
Willis and
you and Willis and the two Sewells and somebody else. I know I got five. Name doesn't come to me now. At least I thought I had five.
Well, Willis and I roomed together with the Indians, on the Indians from, I think, up to about 1938 when he left, or 40. I forget when he left Cleveland now. It was around 38, 39, I guess, when he left.
Yeah.
We roomed together all those years.
I think he mentioned that when he wrote back to me. You two have been roommates. Well, can't find what I want now. Anyway, you had an awful lot of good pitchers through those years. Clint Brown.
Yeah. He did a great job in relief the last few years. Yeah. He's got to be a good relief pitcher. He was also a good starter when he was with us, too.
Yeah. And Oral Hildebrand.
Yeah. Hildy was a...
Bonnie Pearson?
Bonnie Pearson, yeah. He had good stuff.
did he have better years with the Yankees?
Oh, yes. He had his good years with the Yankees.
So that's how.
Monty had a real live fastball.
George Uly. Him, yeah. He lives right outside Cleveland still.
Yeah, practically in Cleveland there.
Bay Village, I think. That's right.
Suburb.
There's somebody else there that I wanted to get around Cleveland, and they didn't reply. Oh, Red Ruffing.
Oh, well, Red is a victim of a stroke.
Oh, really?
And he's been in a wheelchair for, a long time, quite a while.
Oh, I didn't know that.
And he doesn't get around much.
Mm-hmm. Well,
his wife, Pauline, any place he goes, she's got to take him. I did see him at the... last Hall of Fame deal, Ohio Hall of Fame.
Mm-hmm.
When I was inducted in 78 or 79, I forget.
Yeah, he was there.
He was there.
Is his speech affected?
Not so much, no. Mm-hmm. But a little, you know. Yeah. And he got him pretty good.
Maybe his memory to some extent, too. You can't tell.
It's possible.
Yeah.
But he's been in that chair for a long time now.
Johnny Allen. Was quite a pitcher.
Great.
Wasn't he a kind of a firebrand?
Oh, he was a tough pitcher, boy, I'll tell you. When he was with the Yankees, I used to pitch against him when he was with the Yankees, and he was one pitcher I didn't like to hit against.
Uh-huh.
He was rough out in the mound. He'd come from the side, you know, and it was tough to pick up his ball. And he would push hitters back, you know. But Johnny had some good years in Cleveland.
Do I remember that it was either not, maybe not his first, but somewhere in his earlier years, he went 15-0 till the last game of the season.
Right. In Detroit.
And lost a tough one.
1-0.
Yeah.
And it was, they scored a run on a little ground ball to Sammy Hale.
Third base.
And Sammy probably would have picked up the same kind of a ground ball 100 times, you know.
Yeah.
But this one just took that last little bad hop and rolled over his glove and scored a run for Detroit, and that's what cost Johnny his streak.
Yeah. Shame.
Oh.
I bet he tore up the clubhouse that day or something.
Well, he's a rough guy. He hated to lose.
Yeah.
But we were leaving right after that game. We had to go back to Cleveland on the Mercury then, in those years of the train.
Mm-hmm.
And he got over it, though, after a while.
Yeah. Do I understand that Bob Feller is kind of down and out these days? Have you heard that story?
No.
No?
No. Bob had had some problems for a while. He divorced his wife, you know, and then he was with Sheraton Hotel and publicity work. And I think that during his divorce proceedings, he had an insurance company too, you know, in Cleveland there. But I think his divorce, it took a lot of money.
Ate up a lot of that, too.
Yeah, and then he, he still made a lot of speeches and everything, you know.
Uh-huh.
Now he's publicity director, but he does a lot of publicity for the Indians.
Oh.
Cleveland Indians.
Right.
Yeah.
He's there right now.
Well, I'm glad to hear that. Earl Whitehill was over the hill.
Well, not so much when he was with us.
No.
First year or so, a year or so he was with us, he was still pitching good ball.
Did he come from Detroit to you people?
Right. Yeah. Washington.
Washington. Okay. I guess it was Detroit, Washington, Cleveland, then he went on to the Yankees, I think, and was in one or more World Series with them. I remember.
Well, I don't know where he went from Indians, but he pitched some good ball with the Indians.
Oh, I'm sure he had it in those years.
Whitehill, 23-32 in Detroit, 33-38 Washington, 37-38 Cleveland, and finished with 39 in Chicago Cubs.
He was another pitcher like Johnny Allen. Hated to lose.
I haven't found any yet that were very fond of losing.
Oh, I'll tell you, they really hate to lose.
When you got there, I guess old Sarge Bagby was gone.
Right.
His son came along.
Right.
And you probably knew the son, but
in
the son
the late
was...
30s, though. That was about 40 or something like that.
Son was a pale shadow of the old man, I guess.
Well,
Bagby pitch the dad.
Yeah.
Jim wasn't bad.
Yeah, no.
He was a good pitcher. I heard a lot about him, when I was there.
I think my memory tells me that young Jim and somebody else combined to break DiMaggio's 56-game hitting streak.
Al Smith.
With the help of Kenny Keltner. That was a big deal. Kenny made the stop.
The crucial one.
Yeah, that's right.
Was Moose Salters anything other than a power hitter?
No. He was an average outfielder.
Yeah.
Could hit a ball hard.
Was Keltner as good at third base as Rosen, let's say?
Yes, I think he was a better third baseman than Rosen. Kenny was... good fielder, good defensive third baseman, also a good hitter, And he was always in a rough part of the lineup there in Cleveland. He, Boudreaux and some of the hitters ahead.
Yeah.
Him, and it seemed like every time he got up after Boudreaux or somebody else, he'd get a double, and then Robinson or somebody would get a base hit, and they'd knock Kenny down. See? By the time they get to Kenny, they knock him down.
Yeah.
He was hitting that sixth position a lot.
Now that was the same Eddie Robinson that got fired in Texas the other day, wasn't it?
Yeah.
He moved from Cleveland to the White Sox. Had some good years with the White Sox.
Yes, he did.
Yeah. I remember one game I would like to forget. Went up to watch him one evening play the Yankees, and in the first... four or maybe five innings, Robinson drove in six or seven runs, home run and doubles and everything else. Sox were leading 7-0. Yankees pecked away, came up to the ninth inning, and they were still behind 7-6, but had the bases loaded and Mickey Mantle coming up, and the manager called in left-hander that used to be with Boston. Name eludes me now. And wouldn't you know it, Mantle parked it in the left field seats. I had my kids with me, three of them. I said, let's get the hell out of here. We went home. Then many years later, after I retired in Notre Dame, I'd been a Latin American specialist in Latin American literature and history and language, Portuguese, Spanish, so forth. Spent a lot of time in Latin America in one way or another. And when I retired in Notre Dame, took a job in the Dominican Republic running a private foundation. And they have a big resort hotel over there, Casa de Campo. And one weekend at a cocktail party, there was Mickey Mantle and
Ken Harrelson and a bunch of golfers, Arnold Palmer and Johnny Miller and others that had flown down for a tournament, I guess. So I talked to Mickey for nearly an hour, and I told him about that game. The pitcher was Chuck Stobbs.
Oh, yeah.
And I said, I saw you hit that thing off stuck to Chuck Stobbs, and I could have murdered you with great pleasure that night. He says, you know, I never knew why that manager brought Stobbs in. I'd always hit him like my cousin. And when Stobbs came in, he shrugged his shoulders and shook his head, and I knew that he was whipped before he threw the first ball.
Yeah. That's something.
Yeah. How about Raleigh Hemsley? Wasn't he a tough character to handle?
Well, not too much. His worst enemy was drinking.
Yeah.
And
because he was talented.
Yeah, but Raleigh himself was a nice guy, and he was a good receiver,
mm-hmm.
good catcher.
No doubt of that.
But as I say, his worst enemy was his drinking, but he handled pitchers very good.
Mm-hmm.
And just a shame that he...
That's right.
He had that problem. But when he got to Cleveland, the AA got a hold of him, somebody did, and
straightened him out.
Yeah.
Good. Glad to hear it. Was the G. Walker that played for you same as Gerald Walker?
Yeah.
But
he was only with us a short time.
He lives in Memphis, and I'm trying to reach him, too. I'll give him a call when I get there and find out if he can talk with me. How good was Joe Gordon?
Very good. Joe, I don't think, as far as the second baseman, he was one of the best defensive second basemen uh-huh. I've seen. He could do everything around second base.
Uh-huh.
And as a hitter, he had power.
He had power. Yeah.
You know, I don't think he hit 300 or more too often, but
probably not.
He was a hitter like Yogi Berra. If he hit 270, 280,
yeah.
He was a tough 280 hitter.
Yeah. When he finished up.